Welcome. This is Bob Dobbs and Cameron McEwen with our 65th episode on figuring out what my book's about. It's titled What You Don't Know About Donald Trump and the Tech Body. Something like that. Haven't looked at the title in a long time. Been lost in the rabbit hole of talking to Cameron to figure out what the heck did I mean. So maybe the title's not even accurate. So we did on page of my book, if you have a copy of it, we did 130 and then into 131, a very important quote from page 200 in from Cliched Archetype, 1970. And then there's a commentary that I did to some friend of mine just to have a translation of the more technical talk in the essay part. So we never got there, Cameron and I, to what I said. But Cameron would like to say something about that quote that I found from 1970 in Rolling Stone magazine about pre-tribal awareness, some kind of private citadel or just citadel of consciousness, the individual. So what were you going to say, Cameron, about that?
Right. So it ties in with the some of the quotations that you've introduced over the past about 10 pages. But if we just go to page 130, immediately before where we're going to begin, you talk about the citadel of individual consciousness. Before that, you talk about the separateness of man to be experienced in the locomotive whistling on the prairies.
Yeah.
This, in my view, this ties into the pre-tribal awareness that we were talking about a couple conversations ago. And I think it is actually McLuhan's most important topic.
Wow.
And what I mean by that is that I think that what McLuhan was trying to do was set out what might be called the stem cell of human consciousness, or the stem cell structure of human experience.
What do you mean by stem cell? What's that? What's the stem cell?
Yeah, so a stem cell in biology is a cell that is polymorphous, that can be, depending on circumstances, it can be expressed as a bone or blood or nerves. It's the fundamental building block of the human body.
Mm.
So
Are you saying you found the chemical element, you know, on your level of metaphor for McLuhan's work, you found the key chemical element?
Well, what I try to talk about is the structure of the chemical element.
Mm.
So I don't say there's one element. I think it's like chemistry where there's 100 elements, but all share a common structure.
But you are saying that the theme of McLuhan, this obscure theme, discovered by me, do I get credit for that? I discovered it?
Absolutely. Well, I think we're both talking about the same thing, but sort of in different modes.
Yeah, you didn't have my quotes, and I didn't have your quotes.
Yeah, yeah. and at least in my case, I find your quotes, and not only your quotes, I mean, you have an intuition that picks out the quotes and leads from one quote to another.
Yeah.
And it's I find your intuition to be very motivating.
Good, productive.
And so, I mean, that's the way that we're kind of addressing your book, right?
Yes.
Both of us are looking at the book as an intuition that, where you yourself make no claim to have made something that you knew everything about as you were doing it. You are listening to yourself and finding stuff, and that's great. I think that's a super way both to create and then to revisit a creation.
Yes, good.
Yeah, so
So you were saying, so what had you said so far? That you had said something at the very beginning, and we should restate that. You just went up to these 10 quotes and that. Oh, the element point. So the stem cell is the process of the chemical elements, something like that?
Well, no, the stem cell is the structure that gets expressed. If we're talking biologically, then the stem cell has the capability of being actualized in a whole bunch of different configurations. But the original structure is what allows all those different configurations. And so what I'm saying is that McLuhan is trying to investigate what the quote-unquote stem cell structure is of all human experience. And the difference between the way you look at it and the way I look at it, just in general, is that you tend to look at it in historical terms.
Yeah.
And I tend to look at it in ahistorical terms.
Right.
But both are correct in a sense, because it's not the case that the stem cell structure of experience expresses itself aside from time. It only expresses itself in time. But the structure itself does not have time. The structure itself is always the same. And so it's that kind of interesting thing here that actually goes back to Aristotle's attempt to explain Plato, is that Aristotle could see that most contemporaries of his that were either direct students of Plato or were outside of Plato's academy but paid some attention to it, everybody thought that the ideas were things that were sort of sitting up in the air, and that Plato was trying to reduce the complexity of the world to these abstract ideas. And that idea of Plato is one that's very, very common in the Western tradition.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people use the term Platonic to mean abstract, or to mean bloodless, or something like that.
Yes.
But Aristotle said no. He said it belongs to the ideas to be dynamic. And what does dynamic mean? What is dunamis in Greek? It means that it's inherent to something to express itself, right? To, as McLuhan would say, to be an extension.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan is trying to do is he's trying to, at least in my view, I'm not, you know, making any claims to have a God's eye view on McLuhan. I have my view, and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. But I think that in my interpretation, McLuhan was trying to define the stem cell structure of experience that is dynamic, that is inherently an extension of the original structure into a whole bunch of different expressions of that structure.
Would that be his term, the agent intellect, he would write in the late 40s, early 50s? Is that the creative?
No. The agent intellect has that structure for sure. When the agent intellect is in operation, then it's the dynamic. Right, so the original structure is not ever by itself expressed. How can I put that? You don't, just like you don't find gold sitting around in the world. You only find if you do find gold, then it's, you know, 94% pure and 6% impure, and most elements aren't found at all in the world. As elements, they're always combined with other things in compounds and molecules and different kinds of mixtures. So So it's the same with consciousness. There's never such a thing as the original structure being extended as itself. It's only extended in different concrete ways of being experienced. And when in the electronic age humans figure out how to investigate this new field, it's not that the field completely captures the reality any more than chemistry at any one moment completely captures everything that's going on in the world. When science identifies a field, it identifies a field for investigation. And similarly with the stem cell of experience, investigation of that, once it starts, can go on forever.
Yeah, now you were saying that your approach and my approach are complementary, which we spent an incommensurable, we spent all last episode pointing out that.
Yes.
Complication. It's not just simple yin-yang or complementary. There has to be, I don't know if we call it separateness, but an interval that is incommensurable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an incommensurability that is the very heart of fruitfulness. It's the very heart of expression or extension.
Right. Now, connect. So what was your insight this week about what we were talking about and my quotes and the mystery you were telling me before?
Yeah, so I've spent many years talking about how difficult and obscure the idea of the subject is in McLuhan. And I've written a lot about the fact that subjects are only identifiable in a certain world. Identity is always tied up with a certain family and a certain language and a certain social matrix and a certain nationality, etc. But that the genesis of that kind of subject is a kind of mysterious force that is prior to that.
And you knew that you've been referring to that through the years.
Correct.
Yeah.
But what I didn't realize is that McLuhan has actually addressed the question of that subjectivity, or at least he attempted to address it. And I find his attempt, which I'm seeing through your quotations, I'm finding his attempt to be very fruitful.
Mm.
So, for example, in one place he calls it the art formula, right? And what does he mean by the art formula? He means that if art is the retracing of the process of cognition, which he says all the time, what happens at the end of that retracing? What do you find? Well, you find the art formula. And the art formula is the sort of the mega structure or the cell of the stem cell structure of all possible experience.
Yeah, and he talks about the formula as key to modern art in his essay in 53 on Lewis. I think it's in that essay he talks about all artists and scientists have a formula. Now, is that something different from art formula?
Yes. The art formula is what is behind all of the different formulas of artists or scientists or ordinary cognition.
Yeah, so you're saying that's the pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah, so it's the archetypal formula that only gets expressed in cliches.
Hmm. Interesting. So is it just the art formula term or phrase?
No. He talks about it all the time. So, for example, on 131, where we're going to begin, the quote you have from cliché to archetype, he says a close liaison between private and corporate awareness.
Right.
Well, whenever human beings are aware of anything, they're aware of it in a corporate way. Human beings cannot be aware of things that aren't pre-structured by language and by cultural environment and by technological environment, etc. So how does that relate to what he calls the close liaison between private and corporate awareness? Well, what he calls private awareness there is exactly pre-tribal awareness,
yeah.
Or it's the art formula.
Now, where does he start saying art formula? Did you notice that?
Yeah, that was 1951, I think, in one of the Tennyson essays.
So is this something he's come up with after translating Innes?
Innes, I think, helped, but
yeah.
Probably Mallarmé may have been more important. But McLuhan knew about this. Remember I was giving you the quotation from his Nash thesis, where he talks about intuitive perception
yeah.
of essentials.
Yeah.
So whenever people experience anything, they experience it as an extension of some art formula, and the art formula gives them the tools to experience the world.
Yeah,
so,
and you don't mean painting and music formula. You mean something
no.
else by the word art.
Yeah, it's deeper. This is the very basis of human experience. So in the 1954 Christian Humanism lecture that you just referred to,
yeah.
McLuhan says, look, this is the great mystery that all human cognition is artistic. And so earlier you referred to
Lewis.
The fact of the agent intellect.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
All human experience has this gap to it between the originary capability and the particular expression in experience or in making something.
Say that sentence again. All what?
All human experience is the result of a kind of leap, kind of gap between the original capability, which belongs to humans as humans,
mm.
and the particular matrix or particular actuality that structure eventuates in.
Yeah, so the he only mentions the mysteries of the subject every now and then. You know what I mean? And you have to notice
yeah.
it, and you say, what the heck is that? What? He doesn't talk about that too much. So,
right.
So
but
then,
look at this. I mean, in the quotation you have there, he says, this in turn implies a close liaison between private and corporate awareness, right?
Yeah.
So that private awareness there, what the hell is that? Well, that's pre-tribal awareness.
Yes.
The interesting thing about private awareness or pre-tribal awareness or essential intuition, all these things, what's interesting about them is that they only appear in something corporate, but they have their origin in something that's before the corporate, that's pre-tribal.
Right. Okay, so I've got some obscure essay or thing he wrote where the artist leaves out what they're really thinking about or influenced by. And
uh-huh.
so I think he said Joyce left out, who did the Pilgrim stuff, you know, around 1200? Chaucer. He left out Chaucer, apparently. So when I quoted the Wyndham Lewis article about Einstein and scientists having a formula, he's saying they're lost on one side. They don't include the private awareness or the art formula.
Right. He's saying that they are saying something that includes the art formula, but they don't know that it does.
Yeah, and so that's, he therefore calls them out on it and says, this is the pattern you guys repeat, and I'm into something else, which is concluding
right.
the art formula. Okay, so he doesn't say about the mystery of consciousness much after the Catholic humanism essay, does he?
Well, you see, I think he talks about it all the time. So in this 1970 from Cliched Archetype passage, he talks about this close liaison between private and corporate awareness.
But that stands out. You never see him say that kind of thing anywhere else in the previous 10, 15 years.
Oh, I don't know. I think he does talk about it, but the problem is that he was constantly talking about it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're reading McLuhan, you read the sentence, excuse me, and then you have to kind of back up and reread it in a different way. You have to continually do that.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you come to see that here's a guy trying to communicate something, but he doesn't know how to do it. All he knows is when he says stuff, people's eyes glaze over. Or, right? They have no idea what he's talking about. And this includes, his closest associates.
Yeah. And he keeps it simple. He's not trying to, bullshit, baffle people. He is trying to get something that they can match to. And nobody has a clue what the issue is.
Yeah, but notice you use the word match. Of course, for him to communicate, they would have to understand that matching is the wrong goal.
Right, but he is asking them. They glaze over because half the human wants to match. And he's failing
to do it. They are trying to match,
yeah.
And their eyes glaze over because they can't.
But it doesn't mean he's not including matching.
No, that's absolutely right. Matching,
yeah.
There can't be inclusivity that excludes something like matching.
Yeah. Okay,
that wouldn't work.
Right, so are you writing something on this?
Oh, all the time, yeah. I'm going to have a whole bunch of posts on pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah, that's good. So you're finding stuff. Now, the sample sentence, liaison between private and corporate awareness, it's those things, after I was familiar with his basic corporate theme, it was those things I would look for. And I said, he's doing something else. There's something else in here. And
correct.
So that's what I would look for. So, but I don't, the language of the Catholic humanism in 54 and I'm not sure about the cliche 1970 quote, doesn't seem to be around. So I'm interested in what other ways he brings it up that I haven't mentioned so far, in my essay here. Where do you find it said differently? Because I can't think of any,
Well, many of your quotations, like on 130, you talk about the citadel of individual consciousness, right?
That popped up after years. That's to me, that's a strange thing that pops up, and there was nothing in Understanding Media about it or Gutenberg Galaxy. What about this sentence in Gutenberg Galaxy? Imagination is that faculty that is not embedded in any sense or extensions of the senses. What a strange definition of imagination. But that might be
Can you read that again? I didn't.
And he says, imagination is, I think he says, that faculty or that action,
yeah.
Which is not embedded in any sense or extension of the senses. In other words, most people think imagination is, you're really perceptive of sensory data, and you come up with an interesting mixture, and you're a poet
right.
or something. And so
yeah.
you're looking at your senses. He's saying imagination is not embedded in the senses.
Correct.
That and kind of talks pre. That's a pre-social sensory cliche carpet awareness that he's saying.
Correct.
Imagination
correct.
Not embedded. So that might be a clue. That sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah.
If you look at the from Cliched Archetype quotation that you have prior to the liaison between private and corporate awareness, he says that it's somewhat along the lines that relate Coleridge's primary and secondary imagination.
Right.
So in what you were just saying, you have two different senses of imagination.
Yeah.
You have imagination as kind of juggling experience in some way, coming up with a new way of saying something, a new way of painting something. That's secondary imagination. Primary imagination is the ability of humans to do secondary imagination. It's the stem cell faculty that humans have that allows them to learn language when they're infants, to grow into a certain society, but to maintain an identity through this generalized experience, generalized language.
When you say maintain an identity, is that similar to detachment, separateness or something?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, when he would say that sentence, quoting Coleridge, and it never seemed to be developed anywhere else, and it would stand out. Like, well, let's hear some more about that, you know, but then there wouldn't be. So there were these key sentences all the way through his work, which would you wouldn't be able to really figure out what's the relevance of it in his media talk.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I guess I do get to it.
Your book is a lot about that.
Yeah, I do. Right. I did get to it in this thing that I did. I don't think I did any of it on my quadriphenic essay on McLuhan done in 98. You know what I mean? That doesn't. I do have the. I think I refer to the mystery of why we, your individual consciousness flips the world through the retina.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that was a mystery that no one had ever figured out. So that was a sentence that stood out, and that meant something to me. So I think I mentioned that, but that was all.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that what the flipping of the world by the retina. Can be compared to the dynamic of the faculty of primary imagination, which flips the possibilities into all of the different ways of experiencing the world. And according to McLuhan, nowadays we at last have the possibility of formulating that field. And of course, the field has to be formulated by going back to the original faculty, which is not a singular thing, it's a multiple thing, like Mendeleev's table in chemistry. And that.
And what I call tactility?
Well, tactility is the dynamism.
Yeah. Right.
It's what's always in between the faculty and the extension of the faculty.
Right. So let's go to my quote, because I begin with Coleridge and Wordsworth. I have the primary imagination somewhere in my mind. I'm thinking of that that part of his Interior Landscape book when I start off speaking. I say, referring to the cliché, the archetype quote, that's tactility once again. Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Wordsworth had a letter exchange and debate. But Coleridge was the first to detect the medium as the message on a very small scale. Now, that would be the imagination. That's why it's individual consciousness is probably what I meant by very small scale. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and the reason that Coleridge can be said to be talking about the medium as the message is that the primary imagination is inherently dynamic. So it's like a medium that, expresses itself and therefore is the message.
Right. Now look at this, what I get into in light of what we're saying. Remember, media are the archetypes of the unconscious and they form the consciousness, the formative process. That's
correct.
Like art formula. In the same way, there would seem to be an echo of the massaging of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious, defined as a technological environment. That's about media massaging us in a complex way, perhaps trying to play down this process. And then I quote him saying, this in turn implies a close liaison between private and corporate awareness, though which exerts the most effect on the other may depend entirely on the degree of awareness achieved. Now, as I'm saying this to the person that's listening, I know they don't have a damn clue. Their eyes are glazing over to what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? I can't see them, but I know they are. So they take their energy, they can't really get what I'm saying, and talk back to it, so they type it up for me. That's how they discharge their energy, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So he says, I say, you have these two features in consciousness impinging on each other, and somehow the degree of awareness gets the upper hand in shaping the private and the corporate. The more aware you are of the implications of what you're doing, you might have an advantage. I like this quotation, the one on page 170 above. I like this quotation because it references the tactile interplay. One aspect is massaging one side, and the other side is being massaged by the previous side. And the degree of awareness is a factor. That's, oh, there it is, the agent intellect. That's where I get the audience of the intellect above. That's from his quote, right? Or where do I get that from? I go, that's where I get the audience of the intellect. Is that...
That must be in a previous...
Yeah, it's in a previous quote, yeah. That's where I get the audience of the intellect above. What is the audience of somebody exercising for himself? We're getting into this with the world situation today. People aren't going to be able to socialize. They're not going to get anything out of sport in the Zoom culture. They'll wander off. Now, they do say the millennials and younger aren't into sports, into watching sports. Did you hear about that? They're not interested in football in that.
Correct.
The industry can't get them.
And I can see that, you know, I don't know teenagers or anything, but, you know, I'm 78 and some of my friends are 50, let's say. And I noticed that they're not interested in sports in the same way that my generation was and is.
They're not watching Monday Night Football religiously.
Yeah, well, usually they don't even have access to ESPN,
which
is the channel for Monday Night Football.
Now, did you get into that habit?
Well, I don't have ESPN either, but I grew up cheering for the Rough Riders, and these days I don't pay too much attention to the CFL, and the NFL I don't pay too much attention to until the playoffs are on, and then I watch the playoffs.
Right. So how does it come up in conversation or awareness from the 50-year-olds that they're not interested? Because you're not going to bring it up. You're not talking about it. So
it comes up when I say to them, they say, well, why don't we go out for a hike at such and such a time? And I say, no, I'm going to watch the NFL playoffs. And they sometimes they'll say something like, what's that? Or something that tells me they're completely disengaged from that reality.
So
but
you
it's not just
you only get an opportunity to notice that once a year when the playoffs come up.
Well, sort of, but the same thing happens in regards to politics. It's amazing to me how little attention they pay to, you know, world events and political events in the country and stuff.
This might be my point. They're moving into some kind of pre-tribal awareness or something.
Yeah, or pre-tribal unawareness.
Yeah, they're getting stuck in pre-tribal awareness. Okay, they're forgetting the other side. Okay, so I say they'll wander off. People are going to start wandering off days, depending on the degree of awareness achieved. The reason this is about the audience of the intellect and voluntary AP, or anthropomorphic physical, or voluntary ESP, is the fragmenting, the isolating, the walling off of the hive mind merged in the cloned ESP. So that is what I just said to you. You know, there's this isolating thing. They're going too much into the pre-tribal awareness. It's almost they can't get a tribal awareness because there's too much going on. So they can't get some kind of consensus and match it with people around them. They are inarticulate about it, and they're lost, you could say, in their, quote, narcissism, though I wouldn't call it narcissism. It is an imbalance over to the private awareness.
But are you saying that they are swamped by a new technological environment, and this technological environment isolates them, but strangely, the isolation is collective? That
everybody is in that situation. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So that they're swamped by something that feels like a barrier between them and the swamp. But actually, that barrier is the swamp.
And becoming aware of that situation today would wipe out a lot of the perception that there's antisocial violence going on all the time. You know what I mean? That this could be the key thing to put out there as what people are missing, that they have collectivized a separateness. It's an incredible paradox.
Sure. Well, and it's not just social environment violence. It's international violence.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole violence.
That's why McLuhan kept on talking about his work was a strategy for survival.
Yeah, and he said in Playboy in 68, mind your media men or you'll catch a cold environment. Cold, violent.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sort of trying to address that. Is the fragmenting, the isolating. So the old cliche that McLuhan, I call it the Madison Avenue version of McLuhan, that most people, if they know something, he's the guy who talks about us retrieving tribal awareness and oral culture. That's so far removed from what we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Yes, because what he called the acoustic environment of tribal people is one expression of the art formula.
Yeah.
But so is the Gutenberg galaxy. So if you want to understand the art formula, which is what McLuhan was trying to think about, you have to understand both of those as expressions of the art formula.
Yep, exactly. So that's probably what guided me in this book is the stressing that people, when you're applying McLuhan, you're missing this private awareness, individual autonomy. That's the rampant environment now. And so you have to know, first of all, if you don't think McLuhan, you don't know what we're talking about, you don't know he talked about it, the non-tribal, the pre-tribal. So then I attempted to point this out. And, you know, someone reported to me that, I assume they were a professor. They were talking to an academic, and they said, "What the hell is he doing? Putting McLuhan and Trump in the same sentence? You don't put that scoundrel in where the special McLuhan is." That was so ignorant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that is what I was trying to wake people up to, that knee-jerk response. That's what I'm doing here. So yeah, I'm sort of thinking that this pre-tribal awareness, well, I have the quote, but I'm seeing that this is where I'm going to I'm moving towards the tech body is creating this isolation / hive mind. On my tiny note chart, I have the quadrant, the Croker quadrant is about the chip body and the Android meme, and it's symbolized by the number 14. Now, it's not numerical values. I have the one represents the merging of everybody in the global membrane, and the four is analog media, cultural positions, states of perception that's flying around it in states of schizophrenia, paranoia, panic, hysteria, and ecstasy. So one and four is what you are, what we are. We're a 1-4 situation. You see, the autonomy, the one, which is that would be the tribal, or what people think is tribal, some kind of merger, the hive mind. But the four is fragments of trying to retrieve private awareness. And it comes up as extreme aberration. You follow? Which then makes people be more, quote, separate. So,
sure. So,
go ahead.
First, I like the imagery you're using there because it's an imagery of the world with satellites flying around it, but applied to the individual, right?
Yep.
And for McLuhan, what is the Gutenberg galaxy? The Gutenberg galaxy is the attempt to get a handle on this complex situation either by consolidating everything into the subject or by consolidating it into one of the objects that are flying around.
Right, and the Croker quadrant is called Satellite Squared. So exactly,
yeah.
we're becoming satellited individually.
Correct. So it's and you can see what happens here is McLuhan comes along to this situation with the isolation of the subject from the satellites, and notice that the subject only knows itself in one of the satellites, right? So it's got this crazy situation where there's multiple satellites, and it's trying to say, well, I'm that one. No, I'm that one. No, I'm that one. Right? It's ridiculous. But the fluid comes along and says, wait a minute, the medium is the message. That is to say, the link or the dynamic between the subject and these satellites.
That's
right. McLuhan is saying you have to take a somersault away from that whole model of trying to consolidate into a new kind of fragmentation.
That's a good phrase, new kind of fragmentation. Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Where the most important thing is the middle, is the tactility.
Right, that you're a 1-4. Recognize you're 1-4.
Right. But you're really a 1-4.
Yes.
You're not a 1-4 in the sense of either trying to bring the 4 into the 1 or the 1 into the 4.
Yeah. And so let's see as we go through the remainder of the book, do I bring this satelliting thing in, you know? I don't know if I do. So
Before you leave that paragraph, I'm interested in, like, you bring in voluntary AP, voluntary ESP, cloned ESP. I'm interested in understanding how you view those sort of technical terms.
Okay, so I begin with McLuhan's title in Explorations number 8, Electronics as ESP. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
That part?
Yeah.
So
that's right.
But then I updated it to 50 years later that people talk about clone societies and cloning hardware and bodies. But what about the cloning of the subtle discarnate state? Whatever that is.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, well, it's electrics, so it includes ESP. So yes, the collective hive mind is a cloning of ESP by technology, and it's doing it. It's ESP within itself. That's the phase where media extend media and not our faculties. But it's the last faculty we have may be ESP, a kind of originary consciousness, but that's been externalized. So the most intimate pre-tribal awareness is probably what I'm getting at with cloned ESP is what's extended. But then you balance it off with retrieving your individual subject mystery, and that's called anthropomorphic physical, or AP. But it can only be voluntary. It's only tenuous to even have it, or to become aware of where it is while it's merged with the hive mind, the cloned ESP. So there's an interplay between voluntary AP, or voluntary ESP, and cloned ESP. So cloned ESP is what Noam Chomsky calls the manufacturing of consensus. But it's not intellectual Gutenberg consensus. It is this total hive mind where everybody is a huge cyborg and going along with the ripple that they pick up every day in their processing and looking for where it's at, which everybody has the need to know what is going on. So that's the cloned ESP. But the technology highlights your separateness from that more and more. So the crisis today is we're going way into barely voluntary ESP and ignoring and sticking your finger up against cloned ESP. Then I would say, go ahead.
Well, would it be fair to say that mystery of cloned ESP is that it gets its power, it gets its dynamic from voluntary ESP, but only when voluntary ESP is forgotten.
Yes.
That it's what could be called blind expression or blind extension.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And the thing about cloned ESP is, New Agers or Gutenberg mystics, they think, oh, if we could only get beyond language and have sort of a less Descartesian body-mind split, and we communicate through ESP. So a lot of the Esalen Institute retreats of the 60s were trying to get people back into their bodies or their other senses, mm-hmm. not just the literate, and think that they're merging with that. But they did not recognize the incredible merger on the discarnate level, way beyond normal ESP. That's why McLuhan said ESP was obsolete, the 19th century idea of ESP, which is like a tremendous matching going on. So there is a tremendous making happening going on, but there is an interesting merger where everybody has what he called collective consciousness. So when he talks about collective consciousness, I think in Ecclesia Archetype, he's talking about there's no more unconscious because there's a transient awareness that everybody's sharing, which is the headlines and the word that makes the market, and the world is all these different cultural personalities are incredibly merged on the chip body level. So that merger, as I say, the hive mind merged in the clone ESP, that's not voluntary AP or voluntary ESP. Voluntary ESP is more and more not being involved in the merger of clone ESP, or at least your technologies allow you to disconnect. So you see it in the millennials. They stay in their bedroom for 2 years. You know what I mean? They refuse to engage. They're hiding from the clone ESP, which is natural because they want to create an identity for themselves or bring back the subject. And it can't be a literary subject, so what the hell is it? So I called it an attempt to bring back the human or the anthropomorphic, which may not be what you can do. It's not going to look like the history of humans. So, you know, they study post-human stuff in college. I think the anthropomorphic physical is a better way. It's not post-human, but the imagery of Gutenberg human is not valid anymore. But people still want to think that they're not machines and they're human. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's what it is.
Sure.
So you have a reaching, a more and more isolation, an attempt to establish the anthropomorphic physical.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's just leave that, because I presented different sentences that talk about the isolated individual. It's like McLuhan, you hear him in recordings in class. He'll talk like I'm doing, and he starts to get real good at what he's saying, and then he drops it, you know? He knows not to get too involved in the explanation of it.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. So I said...
Yeah, it's like Manipian satire.
Yeah. I presented different sentences that talk about the isolated individual. I guess I mean above, the quotes. The first one, then I quote Prospect Canadian Art, 1962, the multiplicity of media. There's so much media that the humans can't be conditioned anymore for the first time in history. That's another way of saying more and more voluntary sharing. Pretending you're conditioned. Like say, wait, what's up, or what up? You know, you're saying a few words in English, and that's all you have to say to remind people that yeah, I'm involved with the cloned ESP. You know what I mean? I'm part of the collective consciousness. it's a very, you know, tiny doing more with less. So people, because they're not being conditioned anymore, that means they're getting pre-tribal. They're not being conditioned. That they are being put in that case by the new medium. So there is a conditioning going on, but very subtle. The person was the victim, the servo mechanism of his technology since the beginning of time. But now the sheer multiplicity of them, he's beginning to awaken. He doesn't get stuck in any one of them. He goes from one to the next. There's what you were saying, running around to figure out what identity they are. She goes from one to the next because she can't live with them all merged. That's a fragmenting, separating, individualizing effect. But it is not the literate individual effect. It's the pre-tribal awareness individual effect. You get that?
Well, I would prefer there to say it's the tactile awareness.
Yeah, okay.
Because human beings can't be pure pre-tribal.
Yeah.
There
it is.
They always need to use words. They always need to be a certain body in a certain place.
So it's a trend. So, voluntary ESP is a trending that the new medium encourages, but you don't completely get there.
Sure.
Yeah.
In fact, you get completely lost in the pathway that might lead you where you want to go, but you can't follow the pathway. The pathway is there, and people have a vague sense of it more and more, but they so far they've been unable to take it.
Yeah, this fragmenting has a huge service to it, you know. They can't mobilize anybody for this or that corporate enterprise. They have a real problem, and so that's why they say it's the death of the legacy media, the death of the clone DSP, or the merger of it in terms of analog media, old-fashioned terms.
Right.
That ain't working.
So same with nationalism. Right, borders aren't working.
Yeah,
And people, most people are completely disconnected from, say, the reality of war. Nobody wants to know that those are real people over there who are really dying.
Yeah,
and over there isn't just Ukraine; it's all of Africa and lots of Asia and lots of Latin America. And people just do not want to know.
Yeah, so the boundaries of gender, class, and race are confused.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of this has been done intentionally, right? The attack on the traditional structures of Western civilization. That hasn't happened through some sort of cloud of new consciousness or something. People have found advantage in that. They have found a way to get wealthy, or a way to get powerful, or a way to control. So what's going on has many different levels to it. It has levels of individual consciousness, but it also has levels of corporate power.
Exactly. Okay, so let's see if I get to that. Then the second one, the quote from Rolling Stone, where he just blatantly says we're witnessing retrieval of pre-tribal awareness, I say it cites the ancient individual by himself. We are becoming like that. We became...
Uh-huh.
Now, what's interesting is that everybody's so stuck on the McLuhan meme that he's talking about the merger and the tribalism. A person like that who's aware of that part of McLuhan, they say, what the hell is Bob talking about? McLuhan never said any of this stuff. Do you know what I mean? He never emphasized the non-tribal. So that's what's really neat reading this. This is quite a new expression of McLuhanism. Based on...
Sure, that's like his appreciation of the book, his appreciation of Western civilization, all this nonsense talk about him being utopian and wanting to sort of become a TV or something. Ridiculous.
Yeah, he has that phrase on Standing Media, the genius of our monofracture by manufacture.
Yep.
No one ever quotes that one. We are becoming like that. We became isolated individuals, but, you know, very primitive. Just look at the porn. Very primitive. We're caveman people. McLuhan has that theme in the 50s in one of his articles. In War and Peace and Gold Village, he quotes Finnegan's Wake. Quote, it brought the dear prehistoric scenes all back again, as fresh as of yore. And that can be all kinds of violent scenes. Remember in Explorations 8, he just has in the middle of his presentation of all those items, he quotes how in the ancient something written about people going next door and just carving up the tribe across the valley or something. It's a very violent scenario he lays out. Do you recall that?
No, but he does talk about that in many, many places.
Okay.
About how the global village isn't a utopia.
No, but he cites the way people were, 3,000 years ago. Incredible attack and pillage. I'll have to find a quote and read it to you if you're not familiar with it. So, I mean, here he is. If he's being that people are interpreting him in the 50s, oh, he thinks he's some kind of global utopian thing is coming. Well, why is he putting this violent scenario in there? Well, that's what he saw actually coming. More violence. So it brought the dear prehistoric scenes all back again, as fresh as of yore. And that can be all kinds of violent scenes, cavemen hijacking women and raping them. That was very primitive, very isolating, and perhaps not much social order before social order was installed. That's another example of the isolated getting kicked out of the cloned ESP environment and only engaging ESP when convenient for the person. That's voluntary ESP. That's when you're pretending to be a citizen. In the corporate social events, the schmoozing events. One has the loneliness that suggests that it's the separateness of man. The human dimensions are lost during the mechanical era or industrial society of non-human ends, and that's a quote, non-human ends, and then while the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers struggle dimly to restore balance and order by homeopathic means. Homeopathic means, quoting, might be the word making the market. That's another isolated, fragmented situation, and also doing more with less. And then the third quote, McLuhan, and I always quote George Thompson rather than Harley Parker, referencing Counterblast, and that should be 1969, not 1968, because Thompson did all the work, he told me, down in New York, making Counterblast. Harley wasn't doing it. He was partying in New York. No.
Well, right. But, I mean, doing all the work, I mean, Thompson just took a whole bunch of fragments that McLuhan had been throwing out since the early 1950s, right?
Yeah.
And then put them together in Counterblast.
And there's, did the graphic design.
That's what Harley did, the graphics.
No, he did it. George did it.
Oh, you really? I didn't know he had that ability. I thought George had put the text together.
No. George was an art student, and he was a student of Harley's at school at the Art College in Toronto, and then he was an employee at the Royal Ontario Museum with Harley, working under Harley, and that's how he met McLuhan, through Harley meeting McLuhan. So George has a whole story, which he told me a couple times about, you know, he wasn't recognized. He wasn't complaining. He just said, well, I did all that in New York, you know. And he could, if you know that he was trained. He was a pretty good painter, too. He survived in his later retired years by selling his painting. So people don't know that about George, right?
No. When I met George in Nova Scotia, he was very sort of reticent.
Yep.
I'd be sitting there with him and Sanderson, and Sanderson would be talking, and you could see that George wanted to say something, but he would never interrupt. He would never interject himself. And I felt bad. I thought, George, maybe he has something interesting to say, but I didn't find a way to involve him. He didn't seem to want to be involved.
Yeah, George... I know exactly what you're talking about, but since I had time to be around him at the office when no one's around, we would talk, and he was very personable and he'd tell me stuff. And basically, he had your attitude. There ain't anybody here, Bob, that understands Marshall. And he felt that he did, you know what I mean? And he did, because he saw so much and heard so much, and he was an artist and he could take it in. So I would say part of the irritation that you saw in him, it's not a frustration to speak. He was irritated at you and George, that you guys weren't fucking knew what you're talking about.
Which is also possible.
Yeah, he was very critical of everybody. And very, I found out from now on, very critical of me. He thought I was really screwed. So George was a bit of an eccentric. He saw a lot, probably didn't have the intellectual literate levels of being able to articulate it, but he knew that nobody was getting near it with the words they were using. But he didn't know the words to express his more refined understanding of McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Nelson and I used to talk about that. The difference between Marg Stewart and George is very interesting, because Marg she understood Marshall well, and Ion says that Marg should be given the credit because she wrote all the stuff. She typed it up and had to put the grammar in. So so I fortunately had friendships with both. In the long run, more with Marg, but you can see how much inside knowledge I got from those two people. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Just by exchanging with them. So, I mean, George once said to me, Marshall's not a Catholic. I don't know if I brought it up, but he's the first guy to say, that's right. You line up Marshall with 1,000 Catholics, not like any of them. He's not a Roman Catholic. So that, he was the only guy to say that. Now try to say that around Eric or Corinne or something or any of the other Catholics around him, right? They're not going to tolerate that. But it was a very sophisticated statement. As a matter of fact, you could say maybe Marshall was a deeper Catholic than anybody, but it was not in any recognizable Catholic references. You know what I mean?
Sure. But that range is sort of included in the very word Catholic.
Yeah, that's right.
Catholic means universal, and Marshall was sort of at the extreme end of
he was incorporating new aspects of the universal that were happening,
yeah,
being created.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so then the third quote, no matter, page 135 of Counterblast, no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall. For it is not accessible to the mass media. Now, that's like a metaphysical statement, but the global theater of the 60s was not conditioning people, so that was kind of being retrieved. Do you know what I mean? The part that was not accessible to mass media, which we're calling
right.
the pre-tribal thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I said that.
That's because no matter what extreme of control is exercised, it has to draw its power from the pre-tribal awareness. So that means that, as we said in, there was a quote maybe 10 pages ago where it reminded me of the idea that even the I'm drawing a blank on the a technical word, but let's say even the oppositional can express resonance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
We came across that. So the reason that the citadel of individual consciousness is not accessible to the control of mass media is that although individual consciousness powers mass media, it remains there in its absence or in its being forgotten.
I think I get that. And look at my next sentence. The basic structure of humans may be private. That's your stem cell.
Yeah.
Wow. It was a, you know, I was trying to, like, you can just see people, they think private is Gutenberg. They say, what the hell is Bob talking about here? You know what I mean? Like, he's got it all wrong. But the way we're talking about it, it makes sense. The basic structure of humans may be private, but then you start creating society, and they're not so private, not so independent. But McLuhan says, in the end, quote, in the end, media don't affect the essence of a person. That's another idea of isolation and detachment from the merged condition of social communion, or the clone DSP in modern terms. Just a second, I flipped the thing here.
Yeah. Where, so notice how the terms here, isolation and detachment, those could be in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Because isolation and detachment, that is to say extension, that is to say media, those come in a whole bunch of different flavors. And so the merge condition of social communion, that's just one expression of isolation and detachment. There's many others.
Yes,
and
maybe that's why he puts software and other terms in quotes on the book sleeve for Take Today.
Yeah, you've often talked about how the use of quotations in Take Today is very important to pay attention to.
And you're getting with that. You're correct to say I have to put fragmented in quotes because I don't mean literate fragmentation. So it has to be, yeah. Which is how most people would take it.
The problem with McLuhan is that if you went around putting quotation marks around every word that was sort of multivalent, you'd have to have every single word with quotation marks around it. Right?
Yeah.
So that reminds me that at the start of, I think it's the start of his novel, Watt, but it could be, it's possible that it's from one of his other sort of middle period novels. Samuel Beckett has a footnote. He says that he's not going to note for every single sentence in the novel that the person who is talking only to himself. He says this is not necessary to say in every single case because it's always the case.
Yeah. All right. Right. So he covered it with that statement, which is at the beginning of the book, or?
Yeah, it's you know, I think it's one of the few footnotes in the whole book of Watt. But I'd recommend Samuel Beckett's middle period novels like Murphy and Watt as some of the funniest things that have ever been written by a human being.
I'll have to look at that. That's Watt, W-A-T-T.
Correct.
Yeah. So one is simulating the ESP which surrounds everybody and penetrates. I have, quote, merged/interpenetrated. That's the popular mythology of ESP, everybody intimately inside each other. It's a merger of humans via the global theater. Now, that's the global membrane. That's the one of 14, right, that condition.
Yep.
The resonant node. Then capitalism, the afterimage of the printing press, couldn't continue to function while everybody's sharing the same disembodied space and not having to own anything.
Right.
Now, look at the World Economic Forum. They're saying, you know, you'll be happy, but you'll own nothing. They're
right.
Just catching up to the global membrane effect of 70 years ago.
Yeah, they're miming it.
Yeah, and they're not getting near. They don't know that there's a whole counter sensibility to that due to the, quote, atomization that's happening.
Yeah, they're trying to. I mean, it's a 1-4 image that you had.
Yeah.
They're taking one of the fours that are whirling around and trying to say, well, we can reinstate the Gutenberg galaxy by inflating this particular fragment of the four.
Yeah, because they can't deal with the one. Nobody can deal with the one. It's ineffable. It's like hard to talk about.
Yeah.
Hard to say. Okay, so, and they think they're dealing with that, but they're not. The meme of literate individuality.
By the way, McLuhan says that the reason that people find such difficulty in this is that, in talking about the one, is that if you identify this collective structure that we all both operate in and operate through, if we identify that, then we have to subordinate our sense of self to that investigation, to that probing.
Yeah.
And he says people are afraid to do that.
Yeah.
Seems like a loss of their freedom, a loss of their individuality.
Their literate individuality. Their literate individuality is what they think they're losing.
What they fear they're losing. They don't really understand why they're afraid.
Right. And
they
so
just
I
know they're afraid.
I address that in the next sentence. The meme of literate individuality started to allow pay TV and Walkmans and all this specialized electronic delight. And then the computer digital technology continued to throw people back into isolated, walled-off spaces which would exaggerate personal consumerism. Accompanying this retrieval of a virtual visual space, the patina of the archetypal silent print condition, the Android meme digitized and atomized every digital user. That's a popular word, atomized. At least I quoted, put that in quotation marks.
Yeah.
That's the end
but
of the quote.
But notice how, that's what we were just talking about, right? The goal of finding yourself in one of the particles of the four is atomization.
Yeah, yeah. And it's looked on as a value now, and people are celebrating their schizophrenia, paranoia and everything. It's not, it's, what is it? It's retrieved and it looks different. So you think you actually are not schizoid or paranoid. So the, what's interesting is if you had not heard me point out that 1970 quote, and then got into this pre-tribal awareness, which you now have discovered, you might not know what I'm talking about here, unless you could get it, and it was, oh, that's the part I missed. You know what I mean? That I hadn't been writing about.
No, I think that's right.
I'm saying you wouldn't understand what I'm talking about here, but that sounds a little too strong.
Yeah, so I not only enjoy our conversations, I learn from them.
Well, that's great. So, because you haven't read anybody doing this free travel awareness aspect of McLuhan. No one's ever done it. And you had read so much McLuhan, you knew that was in there somewheres, but no one had pointed out the quotes to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking that you might have understood it, but I don't know. You might not have.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah.
This aspect of McLuhan, you know, is not just brand new. German idealism, so Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, were very much into these ideas. They were very much trying to figure out, you know, what is the unity that fragments itself in a dynamic movement. And how are we to understand that? These were very important topics for them in the sort of 1800 to 1840 time period.
Were they still within the problem of literacy, of the Gutenberg effect?
Well, to a greater or lesser extent, yes and no. I mean, first off, they weren't. They didn't think in common. They were all different individuals, and there were many other people that were their friends or their opponents or whatever. It was a very complicated situation. But
were they all Kantians?
Well, everybody after Kant had certain problems that they had to figure out.
Yeah.
So, but they all tried to go beyond him in different ways. So Fichte knew Kant and attempted to say that Kant's work inherently expressed this notion that he had of sort of the coalescence of consciousness.
Mm.
Schelling is too complicated to talk about here because he had a very long career and kept changing his standpoint over that career. But then Hegel had the sort of the difficult problem of trying to show that the literary factor in Kant and Fichte was only one aspect of human experience, and that human experience was inherently plural, broke itself into what he called different absolutes.
Mm.
So the absolute of Fichte is singular, but the absolutes of Hegel are plural. Well, that's a very, very fundamental difference between them. And the absolute plurality of Hegel includes tactility, because you couldn't have a plurality of absolutes without tactility between them, right?
Yep.
So when you say, you know, what was the question of the literal for all these guys? Well, number one, it was different. And then number two, Hegel is one of the sort of great world figures of thought, at least in my estimation, and needs to be reread as much as McLuhan does or more.
Mm. Well, what about McLuhan's second Copernican revolution, which is Kant discovering inner or acoustic space?
Yeah, they would all agree with that. They are the German idealists are theoreticians of this post-Copernican world.
Yeah, and post-Gutenberg world.
Yes, but it's one thing to say that you're going to think post-Gutenberg, and it's another thing to do it, right? Which is what we see in post-humanism and stuff. Have a certain aspiration is very different from the actuality. So for McLuhan, it's not enough to say that we're going into a new post-book, post-Gutenberg environment. For McLuhan, the important thing is to get down to the art/science of this new environment.
Yeah, and probably Nietzsche completes those guys,
but he
has the advantage of a telegraph for 20, 30 years. So he's getting the electric effect, which the idealists didn't have in the first half of the 1800s. So Nietzsche may have completed that romantic enterprise or German romanticism, German idealism, you know,
yeah.
Because he saw it was happening electrically. I mean, it may not saw it clearly, but he was responding to the later condition.
Yes, I think that's true, but I think it's very important to introduce the proviso that it's not the case that technologies were only shaping thought. It was also the case that thought was shaping technologies. Right. So the what the German idealists were thinking in the wake of Kant, that kind of thinking was also expressed in people like Michael Faraday that were experimenting with electricity and figuring out its laws.
Yeah,
so it's a two-way.
Yeah, two-way. Now, I was thinking that the German idealists, they were trying to reach beyond Kant, and Joyce, Pound, Lewis, and Eliot were trying to reach beyond Nietzsche, or were mm-hmm. seeing there was something that had to be added to whatever Nietzsche thought he got to. You know what I mean? So that,
yes, I think that's true.
Yeah. So Joyce and them, they're dealing with what McLuhan called the second symbolic movement, and which were called the symbolists. And the German idealists were dealing with the first symbolist movement, which was known as the Romantics. So there's a split there, or a rupture, tactile interface caused by the telegraph and the beginning of electric technologies. Like the telephone, you know, that's the marker between all that philosophizing, which not many people seem to be attracted to today in German idealism. You know what I mean? It's too bookish or something.
They can say it's too bookish, but in reality, it's too challenging.
Yeah.
It's, you know, too... To really get into a thinker like Hegel is very, very difficult and very challenging to one's sense of identity and sense of order.
Yeah. Okay, so then we got through the long quote, or my oral casual talk, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're on to page 134. And so I say, this would lead to the rise of the anthropomorphic physical, an outcome based on the following reasoning. McLuhan saw that the notion of the medium as the message or message was soon not to be applicable to the law of the situation. Now, I just want to go see, and then I'm getting into the Android meme. Okay. So then I casually say, a business consultant in the 20s, Mary Parker Follett, came up with a sort of a medium as the message figure ground situation, which she called the law of the situation. McLuhan used the phrase once or twice. The law of the situation is an answer evoked by the question, what's the context? Many people see the medium as mere context. What's the context of the event? But that's freezing it as a concept. They're not getting the sensory shaping, the numbing process. And do you agree with that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So then, the Android meme, now that's machines extending themselves. We're not extending human organs anymore. Though you might say you're not completely not extending human organs. There's still a bit of something in there. But it's tending to be a complicated extension that regular humans have no clue about. They can't visualize it. They can't understand the digital medium. So the Android meme, or AM, induce humans to think the AM's content is subject to human massage. Humans are actually not manipulated or brainwashed by the AM. They do appear to everybody else. Each one of us appears one of the following ways. They have symptoms of paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, or ecstasy in the newly isolated, disconnected condition of surplus flesh. That's Croker's phrase, surplus flesh. This is why everybody today keeps frantically monitoring their black mirrors, that's the cell phones and that, and texting to see if there are any others out there, nano communities, might be resulting. So is this making sense here?
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
Okay.
The one thing I would say is the second sentence, humans are actually not manipulated. Do you mean humans think they are actually not manipulated?
That's true, and they are not manipulated in the sense that they're not conditioned, that quote from McLuhan in the mid-60s, that people aren't conditioned anymore. So it's a post-tribal or a pre-tribal. So now, the Android meme is conditioning that non-conditioning.
Yeah. Correct. Okay, so that's exactly what I was thinking.
Hoping I was saying.
Getting to. Yeah,
you were hoping,
yeah.
I said that. Yeah, saying that. So just to review, the Android meme induced humans to think the AM's content is subject to human massage. Now, that's where everybody gets this hoity-toity thing. It's remarkable how so many people accuse everybody else of being brainwashed. you follow that?
See, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Because they don't know that they've been floating off a satellite, and yes, everybody else is being manipulated, but there's a medium that's making you think that or perceive the brainwashing of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You sure. Get average people all over the cases. If social issues come up, they say, well, everybody's brainwashed. They never said that 100 years ago on the popular level.
Yeah. So in my view, you can see this in the shoes that people wear. They, you know, people talk about everybody being brainwashed or people believing stuff in the media that isn't true or something like that. But those people will be wearing some kind of Nike or some kind of sandal or something that, you know, is fashion that says, you know, I'm a person who has been led along this path to buy these shoes to express myself in this way. And there they are talking about other people being brainwashed.
Yeah. So you're saying their clothing indicates the consumer brainwashing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I was.
You can't get out of it.
What'd you say?
You cannot get out of it.
Right. But then people are increasingly, 20, 30 years ago, became more eccentric and fragmented in their clothing styles. And
yeah.
There was no uniformity.
That was part of the that was fashion too.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so you had the four was your shirts and pants and clothes and t-shirts, and the one was your shoes. So you were one four. Right? You engage in voluntary shoes or voluntary ESP. I'll pretend I'm part of the cloned ESP merger, but in my clothing and the eccentricity of how I dress myself, that's the schizophrenia, paranoia, spiraling off satellite. So
right.
that's an amazing new icon or image. The 1-4 is what we all look like.
And you can see the pain that's involved here in that people realize that their whole notion of themselves is being retracted, you know, almost into nothing. But the only way they know how to be a self sort of is a precipitate of the Gutenberg galaxy, right? We haven't come to a new way of being us.
Yeah.
And so being in the middle between the old way that doesn't work and the new way that we haven't found, that's a very painful, difficult, confusing situation.
And did you use the word refracted?
Retracted.
Oh.
Retracted. Right? Pulling back into.
Retracted.
Yeah.
Okay.
To retract.
Right.
To go back.
Right. So
that's another one of your re-words.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have a product someday with that. Retracted.
Yeah.
Retract. So, well, that's very interesting, what we just said there. And so the frantic texting and checking your tactile medium, your cell phone, a smartphone, there's a hyper urgency because you almost know everything's changing every three or four hours. So you check in to see what the new sensibility is that you're going to deny, but you have to know what everybody's being brainwashed by and keep up with that. So you actually are brainwashed with, you must stay in touch with what people are being brainwashed by. And so that's how you assert your atomized identity, is by checking the ESP. And you know what part of the ESP, clone ESP, you can signal that you're part of the hive mind. And so that's voluntary ESP. So voluntary ESP is what people are not doing very much. They're only doing it when they're forced to communicate and show some kind of sociality. That's voluntary ESP. And so you're pretending you look like a human or you're anthropomorphic, whereas people are actually way beyond any human semblance of any previous cultures. So we can't, you know, like certain kind of artists will paint people as monsters, and that's what they are. They're not human anymore. They're not anthropomorphic. So you pretend, maybe that's why people don't like the transgendered stuff. That's taking the fact that we are not human anymore too far. It's in your face too much. You're pointing it out too much that that's what people are being.
Well, you say that people don't like it, but it's probably more popular than it's ever been.
On the younger levels. Yeah. Why did the university administrations all capitulate to it?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah. So, yeah, I see. But there's a lot of anger about it.
For sure. Yeah, but that we were talking earlier about how anger and violence arise, are inevitable in the situation where identity is breaking down, where people don't know where it's at. Violence and anger are like air.
Okay, he has a line in Take Today. Social achieving, creating social identity is a necessarily violent process.
Yeah.
And so you have to be part of your voluntary SP or looking human is being violent. So that's why you would have more swearing in normal conversation, more humor and gesticulation of violent gestures. Maybe that's what rap is. Rap is the appropriate expression of violence in communication that's more and more accepted because everybody knows it's a pretty desperate situation, the dilemma that you were spelling out 2 minutes ago.
Well, look at movies. As McLuhan said, the movies are about some sort of monstrous situation.
Yeah.
And
beginning with The Exorcist, that was the breakthrough movie he would talk about. 73.
Nowadays it's just incredible. I mean, every movie is some kind of horrible situation that has all kinds of violent repercussions.
Now, they say movies aren't doing well. So who's watching these things?
Who knows? Who knows? I don't know anybody that is, but...
Well, that's where the Beaudoin said, you know, people tape all the time. We're in the 80s taping with their video recorders, but not watching it. So he said the TV, the video recorder, was watching TV for them. So there's a lot of the technologies are processing stuff, not humans.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation.
Yeah. Okay, so this is why everybody today... I jumped ahead just a second. Where are we?
We're at the bottom of 134, I think, right?
Yeah. Yes, this is why everybody today keeps frantically monitoring their black mirrors and texting to see if there are any others, nano communities out there. They just need to see a few people out there. So we have many tiny communities or bubbles. Some people use that term to criticize it, but I call it nano communities. Out there, not really out there. See, I knew to put that in quotes. So I said, I'm trying to take McLuhan's vision through the barriers and into the Android meme zone, but I have to go along with the fact that nobody is being massaged. The Android meme is doing it to itself. Quote, humans are actually not manipulated or brainwashed. Now, look, am I quoting myself there? Humans are actually not manipulated or brainwashed. Everybody's staring out from their isolated platform and noticing the emotions in other people. And all they can see is other people in a diminished state. So there's McLuhan said, understanding media, that the domestic home, when TV came into the house in the 50s, it started to make the activities of the family menacing. That would be the new discarnate effect of television, made the chemical body rituals of the home threatening. You know that point?
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that, but to me it's interesting in the sense that the medium is the message. So in order to have a family on TV, a camera has to watch them and has to watch them continually.
Yeah.
Right? Because the camera is not still shots like film. It's a pickup, like a microphone. So the technology then gets inside people's heads where... instead of going about their business naturally and just sort of doing what feels right, they begin to go about their business as if they're being watched, like a TV camera.
Yeah.
And when your activities are being watched, number one, it changes your activities, and number two, it makes you a little bit violent. Because you feel like your environment is being violent to you, and the only way to counteract it is to be violent against it.
Yeah, you're irritated. You're constantly annoyed. So remember that TV show in the 73, 74, The Family, that was taped? That was the first time. They were California.
Oh, yeah, the Loud family.
Yeah, Lance Loud. The violence that happened to them, remember, it all broke up. The family really fell apart.
I didn't watch it.
I didn't watch much of it either. But I was interested in the phenomenon, and I kept up on what happened to Lance Loud and those people, or I noticed if I saw there was something about him, I'd read it. We're going to be stars. We're going to be televised. They're interested in us. So they get a temporary identity from that, but that identity didn't hold up to the larger impact of them being on camera all the time and started to become annoyed. Then they became annoyed with each other.
Yeah.
So I used to think that television coming into the peaceful scene of domesticity in the 50s, which they like to say is a reaction to the violence of the 40s in the war, so everybody just fell back into being polite zombies or suburban kind of people. By the 60s, that's all breaking up, so that the beginning of a lot of divorce in the 60s was due to television in the home, that people were more irritated by each other, couples.
Mm-hmm.
The nuclear family was more irritated. And that also explains why the kids all left home at 15 and ran to San Francisco or someplace, you know? That was an effect, and McLuhan probably saw that. Don't know if he actually spelled it out. He did say that it makes the home menacing. So having that irritating you, what a change that is for human society, say, from 1800 to 1960.
It's huge.
Huge. A monster has come into the house, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
and it was the blob from outer space.
That's right, the monster movies.
Yeah, that consumed everybody, right? Everybody, they had the impression from over 2,000 years of history that they were individuals walking around in the house relating to other individuals, and maybe that was becoming more irritated than it used to be. But in fact, the whole scene was wrong. They weren't isolated individuals anymore. They were individuals within a membrane, within the blob that had consumed them.
Right. And what was that, invasion of the body snatchers?
That's right.
Yeah. So the McLuhan, when The Exorcist came out, he said, it's about everybody being possessed by the modern media environment, literally possessed. So I remember talking this way on CKLN in the 80s. So a lot of the people who knew about me were students at Ryerson, and they would have radio shows. So I met a lot of them. And I remember one guy saying to me, after listening to me for a year or two, and he sort of got it, and he says, it's astounding that everybody let this TV come into their home and they thought it was entertainment. I liked his realization. It was so blatant and clear. You know, he was really amazed that society allowed this to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, more than allowed. They, or we, I should say, because our family, I think, was as much caught up with this as any other.
Yeah.
We structured our lives around it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I remember I think I was in grade one, I can remember what a big deal the Lone Ranger was.
Yeah.
People had TV tables that they, little folding tables that they could take with them to the living room in front of the TV and have their dinner there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so they began to structure their lives around this thing that was attacking them as if it was giving them a gift.
Well, it was
an amazing thing.
Yeah, the discarnate state did stimulate a kind of a drug ecstasy, you know. You were constantly stimulated. You never had something be sort of interesting constantly. People couldn't do that to each other, be that interesting. So that's there was a huge new pleasure happening with the TV experience.
Yeah, and like a drug ecstasy, it was at the same time it was giving them ecstasy, it was killing them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Ion says there's a new COVID virus something. No, a new pill that's going to be stronger than fentanyl. He calls it Trank, or it is called Trank, and it'll give people the biggest, incredible, intense high they've ever had, and yet at the same time it's going to eat their insides out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said, fentanyl.
That's what all technology does.
He's right. It's cannibalistic. So how was fentanyl different from that? And I can't remember what he said. Oh yeah, they don't have the insides. They just drop dead. It shocks the heart or something, so their body collapses, and they're often seen in a pose of shock. Their face and body language is in a shock. They just suddenly, the fentanyl nails them. It's instant, like an instant heart attack. That's different from getting your insides eaten out. So, anyways, that's a side thing that I found out. And they all can see, and all they can see is other people in a diminished state. You see, you can just see it in the pop culture. Remember people saying, I'm freaking out. I can't take it. My family is nuts. You know, all these things that, you know, people would say in bars and things, right? Everybody was trying to acknowledge the monster, but they couldn't see that's what it was. Yep. Or if they did, they took it too literal. They would never understand that, okay, we'll turn it on and for 6 months turn it off and modulate it. We don't have to condemn TV as the ultimate monster. It doesn't have to be that way if we modulated it sensibly in the community.
This reminds me, Bob, of a story. I may have told it to you earlier because I love the story, and so I probably tell it too much. But in the 1980s in L.A., I was at an open house for the real estate people were putting on. And there were people sort of going around to the different rooms, as people do for an open house. And all of a sudden, a woman started just shrieking. And she was saying, oh, my God, I'm freaking out. I'm freaking out. I don't have my Valium. And almost everybody else in the house said, oh, here, take one of mine. I was the only one that didn't have a Valium in my pocket. Right?
I haven't heard that story before. That's a new one from you. Everybody was prepared for that. So everybody was on Valium. Yeah, since I never took any medication drugs ever, I am totally naive about how much people are on drugs, other than what I hear from Carolyn. There are people like tending to be older people. They're on 25 different pills.
Yeah.
That's crazy. You know, for me, I never got trapped in that. But, you have no problems. You run out of pills. Everybody else in your golf club or wherever you are socially has the pills for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to the technical talk. The Android meme encourages humans to think they are the agency of doing, but the sidelining or benching of humans continues. That's pretty good, eh? Even hockey, you get benched. So, so the machines are taking over so many things. So on the cliche level, that's the increasing robots in people's lives. But they were being benched on all sensory levels, not just the kinetic, say. So the Android meme encourages humans to think they are the agency of doing, but the sidelining of humans continues. Even some Silicon Valley billionaires are advocating some kind of media ecology. And Tim Berners-Lee, one of the fathers of the Internet, is too. So then I say, Tim Berners-Lee and his team invented the HTTP protocols while employed at CERN in Geneva. He made the Internet available to the planet of the dead. Which I'm quoting McLuhan with that. It was already dead in the 70s. Or early 80s. The Android meme is encouraging people to think they're doing it because it's disappearing itself. The Android meme is disappearing. But it's surreptitiously on the sidelines, possessing people invisibly. That's why some of the Silicon Valley digerati are worried. They're saying with disbelief, damn, this thing is taking people over. We can't stop it. Now, that's an update of seeing people being psychologically inadequate in the 50s, 60s. Now you see the whole humanity is being consumed. If you're a digerati, right?
Yeah. And so, you have a quotation somewhere about McLuhan saying it's not a limited catastrophe. It's a catastrophe of the whole system.
Yes. So I look around and see, well, people can make money if they take the view that we're wiping ourselves out. So in Silicon Valley, there was a guy named Bill Joy and another one. They wrote books extreme mediaecology, you know, let's all turn this shit off. We're all in big trouble. Then there was the others who didn't take that view, and I don't know if they were upset, but they weren't expressing this grievance. But as you said an hour ago, the people expressing a grievance, they got an audience, they made money out of it.
Yep.
And that's making money out of an old version of McLuhan, like, you know, four arguments for the elimination of television. McLuhan hated that book. And you know the guy who wrote that worked for the ad man that made McLuhan famous. What's that guy's name?
Gossage.
Yeah, Gossage.
Uh-huh.
Jerry Manderson or something, Jerry Manders, he worked for Gossage. And so he had a lot of McLuhan in his youth as a young employee of Gossage. So then he freaked out eventually and decided television was killing everybody. So he wrote that book, The Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. Now,
yeah.
It's not eliminating. McLuhan was tactile with it. Turn it on and turn it off. And somehow have a collective consensus about how much to do that. But you would never get rid of it completely. So, because there were services of the thing. I see that these guys who are doing knee-jerk mediaecology are bad McLuhanites. They did not get to the level that we're talking about here. So I'm making fun of it here.
Yeah.
I'm not saying panic. I'm not being a panic person myself about it. So Coker says humans are now surplus flesh. What's this? I have it continued. So, and Tim Berners-Lee, one of the fathers of the internet, is too. Oh, okay. Humans are now surplus flesh. Their thinking has nothing to connect with, no reference. And I say, that's what Derek de Kerckhoff said on the 12-hour McLuhan-esque marathon exploring the post-pandemic world. That was the first Zoom they came up with in the spring of 2020. A whole bunch of McLuhanites started a Zoom thing. And they all came on and were chicken littles, you know, saying, boy, this is terrible. And so that's what I'm saying. He was part of the 12-hour McLuhan-esque marathon exploring the post-pandemic world, more ancient separated individuals. So they were very critical of the new tech, the digital, and the Zoom, while they were forced to use it in the lockdown phase, you know, the early part of 2020. So I'm commenting on that. I watched them be bad McLuhanites from my position, all of them. So then we have a quote here, Marshall and Eric McLuhan, The New Science, the penultimate sentence of the last page, page 239. As the information that constitutes the environment is perpetually in flux, so the need is not for fixed concepts, but rather for the ancient skill of reading that book, for navigating through an ever uncharted and uncharitable milieu. I think milieu, is that spelled correctly? No, I'm missing another I, I think. I don't think milieu is spelled right there. So anyways, you see, the uncharted and uncharitable. That's McLuhan in the 70s saying he's not sure what the medium is the message or what the medium is anymore. So they're beginning to realize that communication is not going to match the Android meme condition. So do you have any objection to that quote? Do you see that?
Well, I just point out that uncharted and unchartable both have many meanings.
Yeah.
So if it turns out that that human experience is subject to collective probing and collective investigation, that can give rise to a new kind of identity, but it's an identity that arises in flux.
Yeah.
So it's in order to talk about all of this sort of stuff, you always have to locate where McLuhan is coming from. And one of the difficulties with laws of media is that you have Marshall at one level and Eric at another.
Yeah.
And you always have to wonder, where's Marshall coming from? Where's Eric coming from? Did Eric understand where Marshall was coming from? It's a very complex book to read.
Yes, yeah. So that's an up-to-date statement on the surface level. The Android meme had taken, so I'm saying that what Eric, if he wrote this, Uncharted and Unchartable, that's him perceiving the new environment or its effect. May not be see the Android meme, but that is the point. There's no more use of human cognition, human reading, writing, and arithmetic in trying to communicate something to preserve oneself, survive, up against the Android meme. So you need a new strategy, and it's very difficult. I find Finnegan's Wake is a good map of the uncharted and unchartable milieu to refer and bounce off of.
Mm. That reminds me, Bob, that in one of the Joyce essays in the early 1950s, he says something like Joyce wrote Finnegan's Wake from the position of pre-tribal awareness. He doesn't use pre-tribal awareness at that point,
right.
But from the position of the art formula or something. So
right.
You have to imagine a writer goes to use a word, but of course that word is always something. It's always a cliche. It's always something that already exists in a certain context. It exists in a certain language. It exists in a certain use of that language by a certain group. It exists in a certain dialect. If you retract from that word, to go back to the art formula that generated it, you realize that from the art formula, all kinds of other words could have been generated. And so according to McLuhan, if you want to understand Finnegan's Wake, you have to understand how Joyce is continually operating from the position of the art formula or the pre-tribal awareness, and the scattering of words and sounds and senses are all reflections of that original power.
Yes, I think so. And
I'll try to find that quote for you because I think you'd be interested in it.
No, that'd be good. So, okay, there's... I find that quote useful, at least, more recent stuff from the McLuhans. So I'm trying to show how the Android meme is pretty hard to cognize. That's why, when I went on the radio, I would talk technically. I wasn't giving my opinions or anything. I had a limited vocabulary based on McLuhan and Finney's Wake, and most people didn't know anything about Finney's Wake. But I always referring to my formula. So I had a public formula, and I discussed issues that way. If you're looking for exciting new nuances or semantics, I'd be a very boring commentator. But often people found it odd how I was doing it, so that attracted them. You know what I mean? So I couldn't mm-hmm. lose. Wouldn't have a huge audience, but I was trying to communicate the everything's disappeared syndrome. And I used to criticize my co-host, we should not have a show for a couple of weeks, if we're hypnotizing people too much. They're starting to actually pay attention to what we're saying. So it's sort of always undermining matching or getting an audience to understand me. Do you know what I mean?
So. Yep.
That was my way of trying to show I didn't have the term Android meme yet, but that's what I was intuiting. So then I have this quote from Barry Nevitt. He says, Marsh McLuhan foresees that consciousness will prove to be an effect of speeding up cliche archetype processes in the brain. So he said consciousness, he says somewhere else, consciousness is the cliche to archetype process. That's consciousness.
Yep.
And then he says, but that consciousness will have proved to be an effect of speeding up cliche archetype processes in the brain. Well, maybe that's the quote I'm thinking. Okay, so he's saying consciousness comes from the speeding up the cliche archetype process, but it seems to be a later stage of consciousness. I'm not sure. So what do I say here? I'm reposting McLuhan's idea that the speed up of the cliche archetype process is creating consciousness. I'm sprinkling some other key statements throughout, repeating them to help project the idea of voluntary ESP. So pretending that you can cognize a situation, which would explain why more and more people use less terms to communicate. They didn't make paragraphs and sentences. They just say what up or phatic stuff. Whatever. That was a big one. Whatever. You know what I mean? That's
sure.
That's admitting on the popular culture level that the reality is uncharitable. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the whatever, McLuhan wasn't around for that. You know, he analyzed where it's at. That was his phrase. But
right.
I was able to talk about the whatever phase.
Yeah. But look at, there's certain consonants between Eric writing at the end of Laws of Media, this an uncharted and uncharitable milieu. That sort of goes together with whatever.
Yeah.
Right? But McLuhan was saying the opposite of that. McLuhan was saying, wait a minute, if you go with all of these conceptual charts, all of which are false, but if you take them in plenary fashion, then you can get to a new kind of structure, a new kind of investigation.
You get to where it's at.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be the pinnacle service of the 50s and 60s early global theater phenomenon. It had the service of, you could get some interesting overview and think you had comprehensive awareness, and probably that was the appeal of LSD. It simulated that. Made people think that they were getting some independent and scanning view and knowing what's going on. You don't get that in the later phase when it's uncharitable. It's the whatever. That's more planet. That's a later phase of the Planet of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
So the Renaissance, or the feeling that things were understandable and on a new level, and everybody should line up and implement the understandable new collective consciousness, that was an ecstasy of what McLuhan called millennial ecstasy of the 60s, that falls apart in the 70s, so people start to become Planet of the Dead in the 70s, because the android meme, more and more the machine was taking, quote, the machine is taking over, and people didn't see that in the 60s. There was an objection, but they usually were literate people.
Notice how you're using the chronological framework here.
Yeah.
So you're talking about earlier and later, and
yeah,
when this became that, and this sort of stuff. So one of the things that McLuhan is recommending is if we get away from that notion of time and realize that all of these things are possibilities, then we begin to do what he calls pattern recognition.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. But
I
had to use words.
I found the passage in about Joyce, I think, that I was thinking of. He says that...
Wait, is this interior landscape?
This is in aesthetic moment in landscape, yeah, 1951.
Okay.
He says that by an act of retracing the stages of apprehension... Joyce arrived at the I've got footnotes in here that are interrupting the McLuhan's passage, so I'll start again. This peculiar fusion of the cognitive and the creative. Right now, I'll stop there for a second. Remember before we were talking about private and collective awareness?
Yes.
So here he's talking about the cognitive and the creative.
Okay.
The creative is the private and the cognitive is the collective, right?
Yeah.
So it's reversed a little bit. But anyway, this peculiar fusion of the cognitive and the creative, and by that, McLuhan means all possible cognition, whatever, all possible experience arises from that fusion. Fusion of the cognitive and the creative,
yeah.
Or the private and the collective. So this peculiar fusion of the cognitive and the creative, by an act of retracing the stages of apprehension, that is to say, going back from any example of experience to its genesis. So you take the path of tactility from the experience back to its stem cell of possibility. So this peculiar fusion of the cognitive and creative by an act of retracing the stages of apprehension was arrived at by Joyce as a result of the prior discovery. And notice the prior discovery has two meanings. One is he came to this conclusion because he had discovered something earlier, but prior discovery can also mean the discovery that is the peculiar fusion of the cognitive and the creative, which always happens before we have an experience. But it's a before that exists in another time. So the prior is an a priori. Okay, so we say the stages of apprehension arrived at by Joyce as a result of the prior discovery for the technique of fission, not fusion, fission of the moment of aesthetic awareness.
Wow.
So what he's saying here is that Joyce realized how to envision the splitting up of the stem cell at the moment of aesthetic awareness, that is to say, at the moment that experience is created.
Yes.
And so his art is an art of possibility.
Okay, so that sentence, I don't remember it at all, but that's the kind of sentence that I was talking about. Like, he's using terms that he didn't normally use together, cognitive, creative, and I said, oh, this is a new sentence. This is, it looks like a whole new field he's opening up here. And it would just stand there, and then he'd go back to his regular formula of talking, and you're not sure where that came from, what you just read. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
That's your right.
Absolutely.
That, yeah.
And that's what it's like McLuhan saying that all language is stuttering.
Yeah.
The attempt at communication is always a kind of stutter because you're hoping that the other person or the audience is going to pick up what you're trying to get at.
Yeah.
But you can't just do 100% get this, because they didn't even get the first one.
Yeah.
Right? So you have to retract from saying something like the peculiar fusion of the cognitive and the creative.
Yeah.
Because unless they understood that, they're not going to understand anything that comes after.
So
of course, they didn't understand that.
Right. So in a way, those kind of sentences where McLuhan would leave his jargon, and if you knew his work, you knew the jargon, and then there'd be odd sentence where, quote, he'd sort of become philosophical or bring in too many words or notions that we didn't know he was talking about. But he would stick that in there. So that's his acknowledges.
But he gave up on that, right?
Yeah.
This is from 1951.
Yeah.
And for at least, let's say, 15 years before 1951, so 1936 when he leaves Cambridge, he was turning out a torrent of words.
Yeah.
There's, you know, the thesis and different essays that were published in the 1940s, huge number of essays around 1950, lots of stuff from 1953, 54, 55. But all of that stuff is the top of an iceberg. And below it is just a huge amount of work that has never been published and hasn't been studied by many people.
Right.
But McLuhan was turning all this out. But then he realized, well, it's not working.
Yeah.
I'm reprocessing all this stuff myself, and I'm getting some new ideas, some breakthroughs, as he would say. But, you know, where am I going with all this? And so we had to, in the middle 50s, he had to sort of clutch and say, well, now I'm going to go back to thinking about education and how it works. And for 10 years, from 55 to 65, let's say, he's mostly thinking about education.
Yeah.
How are people going to learn? And how did learning break down? And what is the new learning and stuff? And but then after 65, he says, you know, I've become famous. I got to take advantage of this. I got to turn out marketable stuff.
Yep.
So he begins working with co-workers that can take all of this mound of writing that he's done and turn it into works.
Yeah, he gave up and fell back into Menippean satire because nobody was going to implement whatever he thought could be done, some kind of collective action or program.
Yeah.
He couldn't get to that point.
Yeah. But he's not actually giving up. He's just changing his mode of approach, right? I mean, his Menippean satire is an attempt to communicate. It's just a different kind of attempt.
Yeah. So it shocked all his old friends. They didn't understand this change in his style.
Right. Even according to some of them, it was because his brain had gone.
Yeah, and Ted Carpenter couldn't take it.
Yeah, lots of people couldn't take it.
Yeah. It seems that Barry Nevitt could take it, or he didn't care. He was on his own selfish trip anyways. You know, I don't know how much he used McLuhan, but he knew that that's where the action was, so he was the most devoted attendee of the seminars,
mm-hmm.
you know, starting in the mid 60s. He went to more than I did. But so it was appropriate I became his archivist because I was the new Barry Nevitt in terms of attending the seminars for so many years.
Right. But you were thinking through McLuhan's stuff in a different mode.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Barry is the guy that he tries to, sort of distill the essence of McLuhan, you could say.
Right.
You know, what are the things that we would have to understand if we're going to understand McLuhan? And you're more a guy, at least in my view, who's thinking through McLuhan to stuff that is actually new.
Yeah.
You can't say it's beyond McLuhan because it's in McLuhan, but it's not said the way you're saying it in McLuhan.
Right. And yeah, Barry was trying to make it practical. He's the engineer, you know. He says, okay, let's make this understandable. He was applying it, and he missed the mystery part that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So we have to wrap up here soon. When is it? Yeah. So where did I
Sorry, I may have broken the thread there a bit by going to the Joyce quote. I apologize.
No, that's good. No, I'm going to go back and look at that. We move into this 135. I'm saying, I'm reposting McLuhan's idea that the speed up of the cliche archetype process is creating consciousness. I'm sprinkling some other key statements throughout, repeating them to help project the idea of voluntary ESP. And then I say, voluntary ESP is the condition of Web 2.0. So I guess that would be the best place to stop, because I've been doing Web 1.0. So what is going to be the difference in 2.0? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
Well, I know what the question is. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to hear.
Yeah. So, let's see. What you were saying, the Joycean thing. What do you know what we were saying before you found the quote? Do you remember? I was reading this stuff, but I feel like.
What reminded me of it? I think what reminded me of it is you were talking about the benching of humans.
Yeah.
And I had been, as you were going through that theme, which has to do with brainwashing and all the black mirrors,
right,
and stuff that we talked about for a few pages there, I was always thinking that the benching and the brainwashing, these are expressions that arise from, you know, the art formula.
Yeah.
They're things that have to be accounted for along with everything else. So I see what McLuhan tried to do was not merge all of these things into sort of one answer. He tried to take Joyce's move of getting back to the art formula and trying to show the multiplicity of effects. It's like if you wanted to talk about carbon, one way of doing it is you could say, well, here's a diamond, here's some graphite, here's some proteins in the human body, and carbon is essential to all of these things. So if you want to understand carbon, you have to understand how it can express itself in all these different ways.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And so you could say, well, Finnegan's Wake or any sentence in Finnegan's Wake is an expression that is pointing at a prior genesis. And the prior genesis is sort of the mystery. So what
that's so your plural.
I take, yes, absolutely. That's, I mean, you see, if the genesis itself weren't plural, how could there be plural expressions?
Yeah.
I mean, genuinely plural expressions. Right? The whole question comes, it's like we were saying before about how there's different ways of being disconnected. Disconnected can be discombobulating. It can give a rise to schizophrenia or to panic or whatever, but it can also be ecstatic. So how are we to understand these things as modes of tactility?
So if there was an originary plural, we have retrieved that once you get into the...
We have, in a certain sense, we've retrieved it,
yeah,
but not consciously yet.
Right. That's right.
So the wake... The whole question is, can we wake to what we already know in a certain way?
Yeah. And you don't apply it, as Barry tried to. You create an applicable managerial formula. That's for the collective. That's missing. That is an antidote to the extreme private level that's being retrieved. But nobody knows the private plural of the digital phase is the majority. So my talking about fragmentation and all that is how you talk about McLuhan today, that part of him. And we are doing it through the idea of the pre-tribal.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is. I revitalized McLuhan.
Well, maybe. If McLuhan is going to be communicated, the idea of pre-tribal awareness, I think, is essential to that.
Yeah, and you began tonight with that discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
it was a discovery that, for me, it was always a question. And what your different quotations suggested is that it's actually more than a question. It's a
pattern.
A pattern which is somewhat of an answer without obviating the question.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what negative capability is, which is where we started from passage on Keats.
Yeah, I don't. When a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason, that's what we've come to. Our negative capability. Well, congratulations.
Well.
Well, that's very interesting how we... Oh, I thought for a second there's something you... When you originally saw that I was doing macro weather and you were doing chemical elements, you thought, oh, they're complementary. Yeah,
that's right.
We now can switch. I can be you and you can be me. You can do the macro.
Why not?
Now.
I could try. Well, I don't know that... I could, it's like doing figure skating or something.
Yeah.
You're pretty good at certain figures. So I'm not sure I would be able to.
Okay, well, that's, it's interesting where we've come to.
That's right.
Certainly didn't foresee this. But I was trying to communicate something and somebody picked up on it. Well, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. If I reach just one person, I have been successful. You know that cliche?
Yes, sir.
If I just reach one person. So, we'll see what happens with this. I hope
our, you know, we're conducting a dialogue that is pleasurable. I mean, we do a lot of laughing and a lot of sort of joking around and stuff. But we're also both seeing new stuff in McLuhan that we find kind of exciting.
Yeah.
And so the thing that I think we're trying to communicate more than anything else is just that dialogue.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be about McLuhan, doesn't have to be about Joyce, doesn't have to be about anything. Just the exchange as an example of negative capability and what it's capable of.
Excellent point. Yeah, that's what we're doing. Okay, let's see if we can do it again.
Yes,
sir. In a couple of weeks.
I look forward.
Okay, great talking to you, Cameron.
You too, Bob.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.